This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. We thought we'd kick off the Memorial Day weekend with the Philly Sound and a visit with the guys who had a huge hand in creating it, Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff. Gamble and Huff are known for records like For the Love of Money, Me and Mrs. Jones, I'll Be Around, If You Don't Know Me by Now, Love Train, Break Up to Make Up, and TSOP, a.k.a. the Soul Train theme, songs that helped define the Philly sound of the 70s. In 1971, they co-founded Philadelphia International Records and went on to write and produce many of the label's hits. The label was home to such groups as Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, the OJs, Archie Bell and the Drells, and Billy Paul. Earlier this week, Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff were named BMI Icons at the 57th Annual Pop Awards in Los Angeles. Terry spoke with them last fall when a box set collecting many of their hits called Love Train was released. Here's one of them, recorded by the OJs in 1972.
Kenny Gamble, Leon Huff, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, Leon Huff, was that you on the piano at the very beginning?
Yes.
Okay. Tell us about figuring out what you were going to play there.
Backstabber sounds like something like eerie, you know, something eerie like. So that role was like something horrible because that's what backstabbers are. So that role reflected that type of a drama. And it worked.
Okay, so after we hear that opening, then the rhythm section comes in, and then the strings, and it's a really big production, which is something that Philadelphia International really specialized in. Kenny Gamble, you want to talk about that kind of big produced orchestral sound that you got?
Well, you know, that sound of the orchestra was always that was our dream to be able to play. So many counter melodies that came along with those songs that the orchestra was able to put that together. And plus, too, you know, during the time when we were coming along, it was stereo. Stereo radio had just come into really, like, it's putting it in cars. I mean, it was everywhere. Stereo went from mono to stereo. And so you had a lot of space, you know, to fill up. You know, stereo was much more soothing than mono. So we had we thought about the mixes that we could do, and the music was not only funky, it was classical at the same time. So the string players and horn players, you know, we had the greatest orchestra. I think MFSB, that was the name of the orchestra.
How did you know a lot about the instruments of the orchestra that you wouldn't typically hear in a small band, like French horns,
yeah,
or
right,
flugelhorns.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Did you study that kind of, like, how did you develop an ear for those kinds of instruments?
Well, I come in contact with those types of instruments because I was in a band in elementary school, marching band.
Oh, I love marching. I was in a band like that, too.
Great experience,
yeah.
You know. So I had the opportunity to hear trombones and French horns and flutes and piccolos and all that kind of good stuff that makes up a fantastic orchestra. So that's how I became familiar, you know, vibes, bells, maracas, shakers, tambourines, the whole nine yards. And Gamble experienced the same thing, too. That's why we was able to incorporate those type of sounds.
Kenny Gamble, were you in a marching band also?
No, no, not no marching band. But we had a band, and I think that the music that influenced me most, you know, from like the early, late 50s, like Burt Bacharach, Hal David, and Lieber and Stroller, you know what I mean? The Drifters, when they had strings, and they first introduced the strings. And
yeah, strings and timpani and
everything. Yeah. You know, There Goes My Baby. I think that was probably one of the first songs that had a full orchestra. And then Dionne Warwick and Burt Bacharach and Hal David. I mean, they did some fantastic arrangements, and they used all kinds of instruments during that, and the rhythmic things. So we were a product of that era, and also the Motown era, which had the greatest influence, which also used a lot of horns and baritone saxes and things like that. So we stretched out, and plus Tommy Bell, Bobby Martin, the arrangers, they would also make suggestions from time to time. Well, why don't you use an oboe over here, or this, or whatever? And it all worked, you know, worked together once we were able to get in that studio.
Let's hear another great track. And we're going to hear If You Don't Know Me By Now by Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. And Teddy Pendergrass sings lead on this. And I think, Leon Huff, you're the one who discovered that Teddy Pendergrass could sing as good as he did.
Well, you know, caught my ear, you know, in a rehearsal, his particular sound.
He was the drummer with the band. Did you know that he could sing?
No, not really. You know, his voice just stood out, you know, amongst the other voices, and it just grabbed your ear. Mine, anyway, at first.
Plus, Harold Melvin knew that he could sing, you know. Harold was really the architect of that group. Of the Blue Notes. He'd been in the Blue Notes since in the late 50s. And so that's why eventually what we decided to do is call it Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, because the Blue Notes kept changing. But Harold Melvin remained there all the time. And then Teddy Pendergrass came along.
His voice roared.
Yeah, so we called it Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes featuring Teddy Pendergrass.
Did Harold Melvin mind that Teddy Pendergrass was singing lead and not Harold Melvin?
Yeah, he minded. because it was Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, and people thought that Teddy Pendergrass was Harold Melvin.
Right.
And so he used to come to me and say, man, they think that Teddy's Harold Melvin. I said, well, you know, don't worry about it.
That was that power shining through.
Well, before we hear If You Don't Know Me By Now, do you want to say anything else to introduce it about how you wrote the song, for instance?
All I knew, we was in the room in Gamble's office. That's where the piano was, the old upright. When we was just, the ideas were just coming. I don't know how that song came about.
Well, you just go and suppose you got a friend or you're in a relationship. So I said, they said, well, where you been at? You know, I was working. I was doing what, you know, and then you, all of a sudden you say, well, if you don't know me by now, you'll never know me. I mean, that's like a relationship kind of thing where people have gone through that. Everybody's gone through that. Millions of people going through that every day.
But we haven't written songs about it. So what made you realize that was a good hook for a song?
Well, ideas pop into your head.
It was just feeling good.
And so Huff and I, we used to write titles down. You know, we come in with a legal pad full of nothing but titles. And that's how we would get our songs, because each title had a story to it. So we're playing around and messing around and
Pick one,
and then all of a sudden, you know, if you don't know me by now, you never know me. Seemed like it fit the order of the day.
Okay, so this is Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes from 1972 with Teddy Pendergrass singing lead, and my guests, Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff, wrote the song and produced the record.
Right.
And won a Grammy.
And won a Grammy for it. Okay.
Thank you. should understand me like I understand you. Now, baby, I know the difference between right and wrong. I ain't gonna do nothing to upset our happy home. We only act like children when we argue for the fight.
That's Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes with Teddy Pendergrass singing lead, recorded in 1972, written and produced by my guests, Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff. And while we were listening to that, Kenny Gamble, you were telling me something I want you to repeat.
Well, I just wanted to let you know that during the background, see, Huff and myself and Bonnie Sigler, we used to do a lot of backgrounds on records. Because, not saying that the group wasn't really good, but the certain sound that we wanted. And so on that, if you don't know me by now, is Gamble, Huff, and Bonnie Sigler. We're doing the background.
Yeah, boy, they can harmonize, boy.
Yeah, me and Huff and Bonnie Sigler, I mean, we really had a good sound together. And in fact, like on a lot of stylistic songs, you know, we sang on the stylistic songs in the background. And Joe Simon, we sang on Joe Simon.
Archie Bell.
We were the drills. I mean, you know.
Are you
so,
kidding?
Yeah. So if you don't know me by now, we were singing that. I don't know if I could hit them notes again, but.
Well, that leads me right to where I want to go. I mean, I know you used to sing in a group called the Romeos.
Oh, yeah. Damn. We had a lot of fun with the Romeos. And Huff and Roland Chambers, Carl Chambers.
Yeah, it was great.
Winnie
time.
Wolford and Tom Bell and myself, you know, we were an excellent band, mm-hmm. and we sang together. We had sort of like the best part of the band when, you know, was when we used to sing songs like the Four Freshmen. You know what I mean? We'd have that kind of modern harmony kind mm-hmm. of songs, and we did the standard Moon River. We had a great arrangement of Moon River, and we had a great arrangement of I Wish You Love.
Oh yeah,
huh.
Huff would play the drums on there, mm-hmm. and Roland and Carl, his brother, and we would sing together. So we could sing a little bit, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Neither of you is going to do a few bars of Moon River for me.
Okay, no.
You know, I can't even hardly remember it. I know it had a bass line, boom, doom, 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 something like that.
It was great, you know. It was funny. That was a highlight of my early music career as a musician from Camden, New Jersey. At that time, I felt like I could play good enough to join a band, and I kept hearing about Kenny Gamble and the Romeos appearing down at this club in Longside, New Jersey called Loretta's Hi-Hat. And I had a day gig at Cooper Hospital. But every weekend, see, word of mouth is powerful.
You better believe it.
And that's all I heard. It was Kenny Gamble. It was Kenny Gamble and the Romeos. They're down there. So I had an opportunity to be off one weekend, and I caught a ride down there, and they had lines around the corner, people trying to get into this club. They had busloads. I mean, you might have thought the Rolling Stones or somebody, you know? So it took me about an hour to get in. But once I got in, then I could see why, because they was rocking the place. So me as a musician, I could say I could be in a band like that, because I thought I could play that good, you know, at that time, you know.
Well, you know, I should mention early, Leon Huff, early in your career, you also did some session work for Phil Spector.
Yeah.
Played piano on the famous Phil Spector Christmas album.
That's right.
You did work with Lieber and Stoller.
Yeah.
Did you think that was your future, doing session work?
That
or did
was
you
one
think
of my
you'd become
first
a songwriter
dreams.
Producer?
I wanted to be, you know, as a young boy, I always had albums in my house. My mother used to take us to music stores, albums, to read liner notes. I used to do all of that, you know.
To read liner notes?
Then they had liner notes in back of albums.
Uh-huh, yeah,
I used to read all of them, you know. And I always wanted to be a studio musician. That's what I wanted to do.
What did you learn from working with Phil Spector and Lieber and Stoller, great producers, that you applied to Philadelphia International Records?
Phil Spector had a whole different approach.
Like what? What did he do?
The, you know, the wall of sound, you know. You know, you have every individual musician play their part down, you know. Then he worked for hours on the drum sound. He'll tell all the musicians to take a break. And he'll be in there like 2 or 3 hours just working with them drums. So if you listen to his productions, then you'll see that it sounds like nothing else.
Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff speaking with Terry Gross. Gamble and Huff co-founded Philadelphia International Records in 1971, which had dozens of hits and defined the Philly sound. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff. They created Philadelphia International Records and wrote and produced many of the hits that became part of the Philly sound in the 70s. Terry asked them about a hit they produced a few years before they started Philly International.
I think this is the first real hit that you had. It's from 1967, and it's Expressway to Your Heart, The Soul Survivors. Tell us how this recording came to be. Why don't you start with writing the song? And let me say, you're from Philadelphia, Kenny Gamble, Leon Huff. You're from Camden. Close enough.
Yeah, and,
that's East Philly, Camden.
Yeah, this is right over the river in New Jersey. And there is an expressway in Philadelphia called the Schuylkill Expressway that is famous for its unpredictable traffic jams.
Right.
So does the Schuylkill Expressway, is that the expressway referred to in Expressway to Your Heart? Were
that's
you thinking
it.
About that?
Yeah,
that's
well,
it.
Gamble wrote the lyrics. Yeah. I think it's one of the most clever lyrics I've ever heard. You know?
What happened with that song, it's sort of like it's self-explanatory. I was on my way over to see... a friend of mine, young lady. So the expressway was just backed up. That's when they first started the expressway. This is 67, so it was just beginning. I'm sitting there for, it seemed like hours, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I start beating on the dashboard, you know, talking about expressway to your heart, trying to get to you, you know what I mean? And as I come through, then I see Huff, I said, Huff, expressway to your heart, dude. Put that bass line, doom, doom, doo, doo, doo. And that was, you know, that's how songs come, though. Songs come from your imagination. You just got to be quick. You got to be quick to capture the moment for the concepts. And,
so when you were in the car writing that song on the way to see your woman friend, who did you end up seeing first, Leon Huff or her?
Oh, I saw her first.
Yeah, yeah.
So her first.
I saw her first.
So you kept it in your mind.
Oh, I saw Huff the next day, yeah. Okay. But I write stuff down, though, because I forget it.
Now, Leon Huff, did you think what this song needs to start with? Well, first of all, it starts with horns. Like, you know, horns, car horns
car
honking
horns.
In traffic. And the horns are tuned. I mean... there's a line with like one horn, and then that line is repeated at a different pitch in another horn, and they're in harmony with each other. So
it sounds like it.
Are those real car horns, or did you?
Oh yeah, they're real car horns. But you know where that was inspired a little bit by? There was a song called "Summer in the City."
Oh yeah.
Summer in the City. And they had car horns.
That's
in it
true.
And stuff
they
like
did.
That.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
Joe
yeah.
Targe and I, we just
he was the engineer. Joe
he was the engineer, yeah. And so we just. We got some, they have these sound effect records where you can, they have car horns on it. They got everything on them, sound effect records. And so we just used the car horns on it. And just one more thing about that song that a lot of people don't know is that we use the same lyrics in Expressway that we used in a song with the Temptations and the Supremes, I'm Gonna Make You Love Me.
Wait, what's, I know. I know that song, but I'm trying to think of what the similarity is.
Okay, the Temptations, I'm going to make you love me this way. Every minute, every hour, I'm going to shower you with love and affection. That's coming your direction. Okay, you see it now, right?
Yes, yeah,
now
in your direction.
Right,
yeah.
The same thing. Sounds coming in your direction on the expressway. Same thing, see?
Is that cheating?
No, that's being beautiful. That's really taking advantage of... of creativity, you know?
You can say a lot of things in a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
So.
Good. Okay. Well, this is a great record. I've always loved this record.
Yeah.
It's Expressway to Your Heart, The Soul Survivors, 1967, written by my guests, Gamble and Huff, and produced by you too, right?
Yeah, we produced it.
And Leon Huff, are you playing on this?
Yes.
Is you at the piano?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, here we go.
I could take too low. I got caught in the rush hour. The fella started to shower you with love and affection. Now you won't look in my direction.
On the expressway to your heart. That expressway, not the best way.
At the bottom of the bar, it's much too crowded. No, it's much too crowded. So
Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff speaking with Terry Gross. They'll be back to talk more about the hits they produced in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. We're listening to Terry's interview with the songwriting and production team Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff. They co-founded Philadelphia International Records in 1971, which defined the Philly sound. They modeled their label on Motown Records. Earlier this week, they were named BMI Icons at the annual Pop Awards in Los Angeles. Terry spoke to them last year when a box set of their hits called Love Train was released. When we left off, they were talking about writing and producing the hit Expressway to Your Heart, which they recorded with the Soul Survivors before Gamble and Huff started up Philadelphia International.
What impact did that recording have on your careers?
Expressway, boy, it had a tremendous impact. Oh, yeah. And I think one of the good things about it was that the Soul Survivors was a great performing act. Mm-hmm. They were performing places and just turning the places out. Mm-hmm. But it was like a breakthrough for us, for Gamble and Huff, because it seems like everything started to happen from then. Because right after, during the same time as Expressway, we recorded The Intruders with Cowboys to Girls.
Love that song.
So we had been trying with The Intruders, with United, together. We had four or five different records before them. They were building. But then Cowboys to Girls came out and just exploded. So we was on a roll. That's when we went up to Motown. You know, went up to Motown. We had Expressway on the charts and Cowboys to Girls.
Yeah.
Had two records like in the top 10. So we figured we'd go to Motown, you know.
And why didn't you stay there? Like, what didn't work when you were thinking of
I think it was kind of far away, number one. You mm-hmm. know, our families were here in Philadelphia.
Uh-huh.
And I think we were just basically on exploratory, you know, let's see what's up there, because we had admired them so much, you know.
Yeah.
And we met Holland Dozier and Holland. We met Norman Whitfield. We met all these great songwriters and producers that...
Yeah.
That we admired for so many years, and we wanted to see whether or not there was an opportunity at Motown.
That's all it was.
But what happened was is that from a business standpoint and from a logistics standpoint, I think that me and Huff decided when we were there, we said, hey, I think we better try to do this back in Philly.
Mm.
You know, and you know, thank God it worked out real, real good for us. The timing was good. And Motown will always be my favorite record company.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know how you said you kept a list of titles and then eventually wrote songs that would grow out of the titles? Was Cowboys to Girls one of the titles that was on your list before it was a song?
Oh, yeah.
It was on
no
list.
Question about it.
And do you remember how it got on the list in the first place?
Cowboys to Girls, because it's a story. That story is like a story about a guy who grows up, like little kids, they grow up and the guy be beating the girls up and they be pulling their hair. And, you know, they don't treat them tender. And then all of a sudden he grows up and say, hey, you know, now I know girls are made for kissing. Mm-hmm. You know, ain't it fun reminiscing? And the girl, she went from baby dolls to boys. You know what I mean? It's just clever. I tried to, the lyrics that we were trying to put together was something that was a little bit different and a little, like Expressway to Your Heart was different, right? Cowboys to Girls was different, you know, and it's so many other ones, I can't think of them right now, but try to take a different angle to songs. Like Smokey Robinson used to write songs like The Tears of a Clown and, you know, different, you know, try to be as clever as possible.
That's the word, mm-hmm. clever.
So let's squeeze in Cowboys to Girls. It's one of the songs featured on the new 4-CD box set of songs mostly from Philadelphia International Records, but also some of the songs that were Gamble and Huff collaborations before they created Philadelphia International. And this is one of those songs that they did before Philadelphia International Records. Yeah. This is Cowboys to Girls.
Cowboys to Girls. To play shoot 'em up, bang, bang, baby. I remember when I chased the girls and beat 'em up. But I was young and didn't understand. But now I'm a grown up man. I know girls are made for kissing.
Cowboys to Girls, written by my guest, Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff, the founders of Philadelphia International Records, and there's a new 4-CD box set that collects music from Philadelphia International Records and some of the Gamble and Huff collaborations that preceded that record label. Now, you're from Philly. You've been working Philly and Camden, and Philadelphia International Records has been headquartered in Philadelphia. Which was also the home, when you were getting started, of American Bandstand with Dick Clark. And that had a really strong impact on the Philadelphia music scene. And the record label Cameo Parkway, which was based in Philadelphia, had a lot of performers that ended up being stars on Bandstand, including Dee Dee Sharp, Chubby Checker and his record The Twist, Bobby Rydell.
Frankie Avalon. Fabian.
Orleans.
The Dovells. The Orleans. Mm. I mean, it was... A tremendous music.
Impact did that have on you, having the Cameo Parkway label feeding American Bandstand? Like, what did you learn from watching that?
Hmm. Well, we learned so much from them is that our offices, we're in the same offices that Cameo Parkway. Where they used to be, 309 South Broad Street.
And you had the engineer that they used to have.
Same engineer. We bought that building like in 1970, 71. And I think Cameo Parkway was another learning tool for us because they basically had a group of writers, too. They were, Motown was inspired them because when you go to Cameo Parkway, they had a library and they had every Motown record you could think of. And all the writers at Cameo Parkway was basically listening to Motown records trying to really duplicate the Motown sound. And I think... Cameo Parkway and Bandstand. Bandstand, to me, was like American Idol is today. You could get an artist on Bandstand during that time, and he performed his record, and in a day or two, he had the number one record in the country because Bandstand had that much influence in the music industry.
I think the period when you start having hits is past when Bandstand was really still based in Philadelphia.
Oh, it was gone then.
Yeah.
Bandstand was gone.
So you couldn't really break your records on Bandstand.
No, in fact, Soul Train had come in to play.
Well, that's right. Where I'm heading is Soul Train.
Yeah, Soul Train was. I mean, we started around 63, 64, somewhere around there, and you go all the way to. From that era to Bandstand leaving, going to California, and Soul Train sort of picked up where Bandstand left off at.
You wrote the record that became the theme for Soul Train, TSOP, The Sound of Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess my first question about that is, why did you do an instrumental? I mean, instrumentals were basically, they'd kind of fallen from fashion. By the time that you did this, the things had vocals on them. So why did you even think about doing an instrumental?
Mm. Well, you know, it had words to it, too.
Yeah.
You know, the 3 Degrees was on there, Soul Train, Soul Train. I mean, you know, it was singing Soul Train. Plus, too, we always looked at it like Johnny Carson. You know, he had a theme song You know, dun, 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 that's Johnny Carson. Mm-hmm. All right, you take Bob Hope. He's got Thanks for the Memories. Yeah. You understand? Mm-hmm. Everybody great has kind of like, you know, from television has a theme song. So we wanted to give Don Cornelius a theme song.
Did he ask you to write one?
Yeah, he came. He came into Philly.
That.
No, he came into Philly.
Oh, he asked you.
You know, because the music he had on there, he was a real good friend of ours. Still is a good friend of ours. You know, and all of our artists was on his show. You know, and so in talking to him one day, we're talking about his theme song. I said, "You need to get a better theme song." So he said, "I'll come in." So he came in, and me and Huff and all the musicians, we got together. Mm. And like the first day, like Huff always said, we didn't get too much the first day. Mm-mm. So me and Huff went back to the office, and that melody came up. That's so train, so train. And then once you got that melody, then you put the other pieces to it. I'll put that, dun, 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 you know what I mean? And then that did it, you know? So.
Okay, so this is TSOP, The Sound of Philadelphia, which you also know as the theme from Soul Train. And this was written and produced by my guests, Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff.
Listening to Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff speaking with Terry Gross. Gamble and Huff co-founded Philadelphia International Records in 1971, which had dozens of hits and defined the Philly sound. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with the songwriting and production team of Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff. They produced a string of hits in the 70s at Philadelphia International Records.
Let me play another record that you wrote together. Mm. And that you produced. And this is Me and Mrs. Jones, which Billy Paul recorded. And I've read that you have described this as one of the trickiest songs that you did. And I'm wondering what was tricky about it?
That's probably was me telling that. Because it was just, I had a different feel. It was more jazz orientated to mm-hmm. we. Mm-hmm. Cause I remember when Gamble was showing me the chords, because he had that the chord progressions. Especially in the intro, and I couldn't catch it for a minute because it had a different type of a timing factor that was different, you know. I never played a song like that until, you know, I got to learn it, you know. But that was the most different track, all tracks, I think.
How did it start off? I mean, how did the idea start off?
The idea started off with, me and Huff used to go to, it was a little bar downstairs from the Schubert Building. That's when we were in the Schubert Building. We used to go down there every day and talk to the barmaid. And this guy used to come into the bar every day. Little guy looked like a judge or something like that, right? So, you know, we're watching everything. See, we're songwriters. So we sit, everything we're doing, we're thinking about a song, yes. So we see this guy come in there. We said, okay. Then the next day he come in there again. But when he come in there every day, this girl would come in maybe 10, 15 minutes after he get there. They sit in the same booth, go to the jukebox, play the same songs every day. So me and Huff, we said, oh, that's Me and Mrs. Jones or whatever the name we was going to call it. But that's how that song evolved itself. And then when they get ready to leave, he would go his way, she would go hers. So it could have been his daughter, it could have been his niece, it could have been anybody. But we created a story out of this, that there was some kind of romantic connection between these people. And we go upstairs in our office and we wrote the song, Me and Mrs. Jones.
Me and Mrs. Jones, we got a thing. Know that
said it's strong, but it's much too strong to let it go now. We meet every day at the same cafe, 6:30. Yeah, no one knows she'll be there. Holding hands, making all kinds of plans, while the jukebox plays her favorite song. Me and Mrs. Jones. We got a thing going on.
That's Me and Mrs. Jones. It's one of the recordings on a new 4 CD box set that collects some of the recordings from Philadelphia International Records, the label that was founded by my guests Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff. They wrote a lot of the hits on their label, including the record that we just heard, and produced a lot of those records, too. And Leon Huff played keyboard on a lot of those records, too, including the one we just heard.
Yeah.
What do you consider to be, like, the end of the real, like, glory days of Philadelphia International Records?
I think it kind of like around about 80, 86, somewhere around there, 87. Patti LaBelle, we had a big hit with Patti LaBelle around. But it started to fall apart a little bit, like the early 80s.
Because?
Well, I think people started to evolve. They wanted to do other things. And once you get hot like that, then everybody's after you. You know what I mean? All the record companies was after the artists, you know, and the writers wanted to, you know, to start their own thing and so forth. And that's natural, you know, for people to want to do that, you know. So I think we had a good run. We at least had a good almost 20-year run, strong run, you know. And
was music changing also, like hip-hop?
Yeah, I think
music
so. Yeah, the music was changing also at the same time.
How did you feel about that when there's a kind of like you kind of help create a sound and then that sound is kind of becoming a little dated as a new sound as hip-hop comes in?
Well, I was glad, to be honest with you.
Why were you glad?
Well, I was kind of glad because we had worked so hard. I mean, even now I'm happy. You know, I mean, I'm thankful for what we had. I'm glad for what we had. But, you know, it's like, I always had a perspective in my mind. I said, I know this is not going to last. Nothing lasts forever. Right. Mm-hmm. Me and I used to talk about that all the time. So, you know, it ain't going to last forever. So let's get the juice out of it now, whatever we can get. You know, let's keep writing or whatever the case might be. Because, I mean, every song we were writing was becoming a smash. So, I mean, how long do you think that's going to last? I mean, you're taking that kind of energy out of yourself. And so when it started to slow down, you know, I was thankful and... And I was kind of glad because that schedule was unbelievable, you know. And you start to feel it after a while, you know, doing 12, 13 albums a year. You know, we had a good staff of people working with us, but it was no question, it was a lot. Sure. To get one song, one good song, we had to maybe write 10 songs.
Would you produce all 10 and then decide which was best or just...
Sometimes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we would do that. Sometimes, like when the OJs or Teddy Pendergrass would come in, we would record maybe 30 songs on them just to get 8.
Of the songs that you wrote together, do you have a favorite that we should end with?
Yeah, go ahead, Gamble.
Well, Love Train.
Yeah.
Love Train. That to me is the song that the kind of... capsulizes everything that we were thinking about, the message that we wanted to get out. You know, we're always talking about a message in the music, and Love Train is like international, very optimistic about life and the world, you know, people living together in harmony and unity, you know. So I think Love Train is something everybody better get on board. Because if you miss it, I feel sorry for you.
Those Core Beer commercials really made it popular.
Yeah, Core Beer.
Thank you both so much. Kenny Gamble, Leon Huff, thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much for having us.
People all over the world, everybody, join in.
Join.
Start a love train. Love train. People all over the world,
now.
Join in.
Love ride.
Start a love train.
Love ride.
Love train.
The next stop that we make will be England. Tell all the folks in Russia and China too. Don't you know that it's time to get on board and let this train keep on.
Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff co-founded Philadelphia International Records. Earlier this week, they were named BMI icons at the Pop Awards in Los Angeles. Terry spoke to them last fall when a box set of their hits called Love Train was released. He's not called the Terminator much anymore, but back in 1984, Arnold Schwarzenegger became a star, playing a cyborg assassin from the future. He went on to make two more Terminator films before changing careers. The fourth Terminator film takes place in 2018, years after machines with a will of their own triggered a nuclear holocaust. It stars Christian Bale as John Connor, son of the film's first heroine, Sarah Connor. The director goes by the name of McGee and is best known for the two Charlie's Angels features. Film critic David Edelstein has a review of Terminator Salvation.
In Terminator Salvation, machines have exterminated most of humankind and now run the planet. I think they had a hand in the movie, too. It's barely storytelling. It's programming. James Cameron's 1984 The Terminator and its showy sequel, T2, were also mechanical, but their killer bots had charm. Arnold Schwarzenegger's metallic readings and bodybuilder arrogance meshed riotously well with the part of a cyborg assassin, and Robert Patrick's T2 was a witty, preternatural blank with adorably incongruous teacup handle ears. The fourth time out, the bad machines are steel skeleton effects, and most of the humans are less compelling. It's not really the fault of the actors, or even the director, McGee, who expertly storyboards the jangly fights and chases and crashes and explosions. As I said, it's the machines, or more precisely, the fearsome Hollywood machine that sifts through books and old movies in search of the holy franchise, then generates non-essential sequels. The Terminator began with a cyborg villain and a human hero, Kyle Reese, traveling back to 1984 from the future. Terminator Salvation is how they try to get to the point where they go back, if that makes any sense. In 2018, John Connor, played by Christian Bale, the son of the original heroine, Sarah Connor, and destined to be mankind's savior, must defeat the nefarious, machine-run corporation Skynet and send Reese to 1984 to save Connor's mom and also get her pregnant so she'll have John Connor. Of course, every time trip has its perils, just ask the Vulcans in the new Star Trek. Maybe in this time loop, Skynet will kill John before he kills them, and humanity will perish. Don't you love these ridiculous time travel permutations? Alas, the movie isn't as much fun as it could be. With McGee's migraine-inducing jerky cam and monochromatic brown palette, livened only by splotches of rust, Terminator Salvation is numbing. There is, however, a novel element, a second protagonist, Sam Worthington's Marcus Wright, who's executed by lethal injection in the movie's prologue, set in the 1990s. But first, he signs away his body to a terminally ill scientist, played by Helena Bonham Carter. In a post-nuclear holocaust 2018, he bounds naked from some wreckage, looking remarkably buff. Is he a cyborg? Something has been done to him. When he confronts Bale's surly John Connor, he has to convince the resistance fighter that they're on the same side.
They know what you are, even if you don't.
Enough! That gun ain't gonna stop.
Nobody shot you in the heart, and I see that thing beating a mile a minute.
Kyle Reese! He's in Skynet. You do that, he's dead. I can get you in.
How? Look at me. That's why I don't trust you. I'm the only hope you have. I need to find who did this to me. So do you.
I won't deprive you of the pleasure of figuring out Marcus's secret for yourself about an hour and a half before it's revealed. The key is that he doesn't know himself what his purpose is, and he's furious about it. Sam Worthington is an Australian actor who had a brief but vivid role as a handsome hooligan in Greg McLean's delectable killer crocodile picture Rogue, now on DVD and highly recommended. He manages to suggest a soul in torment with a minimum of inflection, and he gives the movie what innards it has. It would be nice if Terminator Salvation centered on him, since Bale is a big drag. Millions have viewed via YouTube Bale's abusive tantrum on the set of this film, and the interesting thing is that he's equally unpleasant on camera. Connor's mission here is the apogee of sci-fi nuttiness, to find his dad, a teenager, and keep him alive long enough to impregnate his mom and save the world from an army of titanium-girded Austrian muscle men. But as mankind's savior, Bale is such a sour prig, you wonder why he doesn't terminate himself out of spite.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org.